1 Samuel, chapter 17, verses 33 through 58, which is the story of David and Goliath. Last week we took on David's aspirations, so we got to meet Goliath. We got to read the story about for 40 days. In the morning and in the evening, Goliath would come out and make his threats. No need for the whole armies to go to war here. You send out your best warrior to fight me, and if you win, then you win the whole battle, and we'll be your slaves. I don't think he really meant that. He had no expectation of losing. But if we win, then we defeat you without a battle-to-battle, army-to-army fight, and you'll be our servants, you'll be our slaves. And for 40 days, this went on twice a day, 80 different times. The men, the soldiers of Israel, listened to the offer, listened to the challenge, and then cowered away. They didn't care what he said about them or their God, so long as that humongous giant didn't cross the line and engage them in battle. They just did not want to have to mess with that dude. But upon hearing just one time the threats of Goliath, David is absolutely incensed. And for David, it is a matter of honor. You know, there are so many incredible lessons in this story. As a Bible teacher, it's like, well, where do you even start? You can just keep digging and throwing stuff out. Here, consider this lesson, and here, consider that one. This is a big lesson in this chapter that a lot of times we don't highlight as Bible teachers just because there's so much other stuff. But honor, folks, honor. In honor of the name of his God, hearing his God blaspheme, that stirs up the righteous indignation within David's heart, and he can't contain it. And he's ready to accept the challenge. He's not just a young buck shooting his mouth off talking a big game. He's ready in his heart. He's ready to defend the honor of his perfect and holy God. I love this guy. You know, we're just starting to study David. You can already see how easy it is just to fall in love with this guy's character. And man, we're just getting started. We're seeing the beautiful qualities of this man, David. He has volunteered to fight Goliath. He has showed up and said, never fear, David is here. Remember that from last week? Never fear, David is here. All you guys, you war-hardened soldiers, quit your worrying, quit your fretting. I'm going to take care of this giant for you. And now we come to the section of the chapter where we're going to see Saul's response. How's Saul going to handle this? Knowing that David has volunteered to be that guy. For 40 days, they've been looking for a warrior that they can send out there to go head-to-head. Well, okay. I mean, no matter how tall they are, they're not going head-to-head with Goliath. Maybe head-to-waist with Goliath. And now we have a volunteer, but the problem is he's just a young guy. And how's Saul going to handle this? Is Saul going to be motivated by his vision for the Lord, his faith in the Lord? Or is he going to do what most people do in a situation like that, and that is just fall back on sight, on human reasoning? What does it look like? Does this seem feasible that I should send this young guy out there to represent us as an army? So we'll begin reading in verse 33. And Saul said to David, "You are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are but a youth, and he has been a man of war from his youth." So he's been killing dudes since you've been in diapers. He's got experience. He's got kills under his belt. He is a verifiable, bona fide warrior. David, you're just a teenager. You're just a young guy, and you don't have this kind of experience. And this is David's second battle for the day. I mentioned last week that David really started fighting the battle before he ever got to Goliath on the battlefield. And that first battle was against his oldest brother Eliab. And I know it's not a physical battle. It's a battle of words. These are verbal words that are thrown out. But I never want to minimize how impactful words can be and just how devastating the battle of words can be when someone is speaking words over you for the purpose of causing you to think the worst about yourself and to doubt yourself. Speaking words that are meant purposefully to neutralize you in whatever it is that you had in mind, whether it's going all in for the Lord or working for the Lord in some capacity. Those are legitimate internal battles. That's what they become. Those words are spoken over us, and then we have to wrestle with them inside to determine, well, are they right? Are they right about me? And what gets even worse is when those verbal attacks, those verbal battles begin to accumulate. So, you know, in this case, David, he's already had to fight this verbal battle with his oldest brother, Eliab, who said, David, essentially, who do you think you are? You're nobody. Why are you trying to act like somebody? And now he's getting it from Saul. So he's getting the same cynical and skeptical words from Saul. And you know how that is. That accumulates. It's one thing if one person has something negative or limiting to say about you, but how much worse is it when someone else comes along and confirms what that other person said? And then all the worse when that seems to be the general consensus of the people around you. That you're not good enough, that you're not qualified enough, that you're not capable enough, that God wouldn't use you in that way, that you don't have the qualifications, the resume. And then that's where that battle gets really intense. This is what everyone else is saying, so it seems like it would make good sense for me to take a majority opinion here. It seems like they must be right about me. I'm not capable. I shouldn't be considering this. I shouldn't go all in like I'm wanting to. This is something I want to do for the Lord, but I can't because I'm just not qualified or capable. Those are difficult battles. And these are the kind of battles that David is facing before he gets to the actual battlefield. It's like David now with Saul being on Israel's Got Talent, you know, and he's trying out for the spot. And Saul's one of the judges and saying, you know, it's a no for me. David, you're not capable. You're not the guy we're looking for. You can't do this. So now David, what he's going to do is after pushing past this second battle, he's going to draw from his past. He's going to speak to Saul using his past in order to establish for King Saul that King Saul is wrong about David. King Saul does not think that David is experienced enough to do this. He doesn't think he's the right kind of person. David's going to show, he's going to prove from his past, yes, I am. He did not need to prove that to Eliab, his older brother. And that's why I think it was so wise for David to just excuse himself from the conversation. We read he just, you know, turned away and went to someone else and talked with someone else. He excused himself from that conversation. Nothing to prove there. And you know how it is with siblings. So, well, not my brother. We're perfect relationship, but from what I see of other people's relationships, you know how it can be with siblings. No matter what you say and no matter what you do, you know what, I better just leave the point alone. But see, with Saul, he does have something to prove. Because Saul's the guy that's going to say, okay, yeah, you're going to be our guy. Or he's going to be the guy that says, no, I'm doubling down, you can't be our guy. So let's see what David says, verse 34. But David said to Saul, your servant, which of course is a very humble way to address king, quote unquote, king Saul. Wouldn't that have to be tough? Like, I know I'm the king. God anointed me the king. God poured his spirit on me. God took his spirit from Saul. But no, very humble, very respectful. He says, your servant used to keep sheep for his father. Still was, actually, up until this time. And when there came a lion or a bear. Now, hold on just a second. Please keep in mind, he's giving you a summary statement here. He's not talking about a particular lion or a particular bear. He's actually talking about multiple lions and multiple bears. He's going to clear that up in verse 36. He's going to tell us that he's killed lions. No, it is verse 36. That he's killed lions, plural, and that he's killed bears, plural. So what he's doing right now is he's giving you a summary statement that's talking about how he handled these situations where lions or bears would try to get his sheep. Listen to this. I mean, this is just incredible stuff. When there came a lion or a bear and took a lamb from the flock, verse 35, I went after him and struck him and delivered it out of his mouth. And if he arose against me, I caught him by his beard. So he would be talking about lions there, because bears don't have beards, lions do. But, I mean, just listen to this crazy story, and it's a truthful story. If a lion rose against me, I caught him by his beard and struck him and killed him. In verse 34, we learn that there is no such thing as an unnecessary battle or a pointless battle. Now, don't try to tell me you haven't felt that way about some of the battles that you've had to go through in life. I know you have. I have. I still do. I have to remind myself at times everything that I know. There are no unnecessary battles. There are no pointless battles. Even when you're going through something and you're tempted to feel that way because you cannot think of a single good reason why you would have to be battling through that thing, or a single good purpose of what good could possibly come from that battle you're in. It doesn't seem like it's purposeful or helpful in any way. No possible way for it to be. In fact, it feels rather unfair, cruel even, certainly unnecessary. Well, what about poor David here? He was just minding his own business, taking care of his father's business, which was the sheep business. That was their livelihood. That was the way that they survived. They were not highfalutin. They didn't have a lot of money. This was a poorer family from a poorer community, Bethlehem. And sheep farming was their lifestyle. They depended on that financially. Like, every single sheep mattered. Sheep lives mattered to this guy and to his family. Their financial well-being depended on how well each one of those sheep were doing. And then here we have at least four different occasions where there's only one way you could look at it. Four different occasions where God allowed a lion or a bear to attack the sheepfold of the family of David and begin or attempt to begin to run off with one of their lambs. Now, many a professing Christian at that point in a situation like that would just completely have their faith in God rocked. Because you know how we look at things like this. We go through something like that, and just keeping it in David's situation, it would be questions like this. Lord, how could you allow this lion or this bear to run off with one of our sheep? How could you allow this attack on our business? Lord, you know this is how we survive. You know this is our financial well-being right here. How could you allow this to happen? Don't you care about this family? Didn't you hear me earlier when I prayed a prayer of protection over the flock? Lord, why did you let this happen? Well, God had very good reasons for letting that happen to David and his family. And all of that is teaching us something. It's teaching us that God has reasons and purposes for every single battle that we go through in life, even the ones that seem pointless, useless, worthless, unnecessary to us. God has purposes. What were his purposes for David? Well, not just so that when David was old, he would have some killer stories to tell. Like, let's go see Grandpa. Let's hear about the lions again, when he grabbed that lion by his beard. Not just so that he would have killer stories to tell in his old age. Not so that he would have a lot of really cool animal heads to hang on the wall of the game room. Those seemingly pointless and unnecessary battles in the early life of David, there in the sheep field, those were for the purpose of preparation and training for what he was going to have to face in the future. And don't you know it works the same way for you? All of your pointless and worthless and unnecessary battles, they're not that at all. God is using those to train you, because it's from moments like that that we build history with God. History that makes us more stable in our faith, so that in the future when the time does come and we need a rock solid faith, well, the Lord has already been cultivating that in us for years. So by the time you get to your giants, you're ready for your giants. What I love about the Lord is he never throws us to the giants for our first fight. Isn't that wonderful? He never says, all right, you've been a Christian for 2 weeks now. It's time for you to do something. Here's like toughest battle you're ever going to face in your life. Go for it. You're 2 weeks old. You should be able to handle this. Thank the Lord that he gives us plenty of warm-up battles, the kind of battles we're talking about here. He gives us plenty of opportunity to practice fighting those battles and learning to trust in God through those battles. That's why we can't take any of them for granted. We can't get frustrated with any of them. I know no one else is seeing you. You're going through that on your own in private. It doesn't seem fair. It doesn't seem right. What's the point? There is a point. The Lord is building a history with you. He's building a stable faith in you so that when the time comes for you to face a giant, then you're going to be ready for that giant. So no, David is not in over his head here or out of his element. He's going to say in just a moment, yeah, taking down Goliath, that's nothing. That's nothing new. I'm used to this. He's just going to be another in a long line of kills for me. So yeah, he's not in over his head. David's not out of his element. He's got a firm history with the Lord. And this moment is not too big for him. He's ready for it. And he's well established that to Saul. He's let Saul know that, yes, Goliath may be a fearless killer, but Saul, so am I. I'm a fearless killer in my own right. I've got experience with this. I'm ready to meet this challenge. Before we move on, can I just take a moment to stop and marvel over the fact that David was a brave enough person that when a lion would turn on him to attack him as he's trying to rescue one of his lambs, that David was the kind of man that would grab the lion by the beard and then smite it and kill it. Just, okay, forget the killing it part. He was the kind of guy that was brave enough to grab a lion by the beard. Isn't that like crazy bravery? There's no way that I would ever do that, even if I had a 50 caliber pistol in the other hand. I'm still not doing that. You know what I would do if a lion was attacking me? I'd kneecap whoever was beside me and take off running. That's what I would do. By no means, no, I am joking about that, but by no means would I ever have the courage or the faith in God to grab a lion by the beard, because the way I would look at things is I would look at things like this: God, I think you expect some common sense from me. And it's just, it doesn't jive with my common sense to grab a lion by the beard and then expect you to bail me out. That may not be your will for me. But just incredible, incredible bravery. Verse 36, your servant, still talking to Saul here, your servant has struck down both lions, plural, and bears. So that's at least two lions and at least two bears. And this uncircumcised Philistine, and what he means by a statement like that is that this guy does not have a covenant with God. He's not circumcised. That was the sign of the covenant. This guy does not know God. He doesn't have God. We're the people of God. I'm the Lord's. He's not. He's an uncircumcised Philistine, and he shall be like one of them, for he has defied the armies of the living God. Verse 37. And David said, the Lord, Yahweh, who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. And Saul said to David, go, and the Lord be with you. Now, there is a big difference between the bravery of Saul, between Goliath's bravery and David's bravery, between Goliath's experience and David's experience, and the kind and the quality of that really ends up giving David the advantage in this battle. I know you can only say that if you're a spiritual person and not just a common sense, natural kind of person, but it's true. They come at this from completely different sides. Goliath is brave because Goliath is big and strong. Goliath is experienced because Goliath has killed many men in battle. But David is not brave because David is big and strong. And David isn't experienced in the fact that he has killed many men in battle. David credits his victories over lions and bears to God. That's the difference here. David does not believe that he won those battles. He believes that God has won those battles for him. So here's what David knows coming into this situation. He knows that Goliath is fighting Goliath's battle. And he knows that God is fighting David's battle. That's a huge difference. That makes all of the difference in the world. And now just contrast how David is approaching this with how the rest of the nation of Israel and their soldiers are approaching this. As far as the rest of the nation is concerned, their view of God would diminish based on how big the obstacle is. But for David, it was the opposite. The obstacle would diminish based upon his viewpoint of how big his God was. So no one else in the nation could get past just how big and strong Goliath was, but to David, that like wasn't even a factor. If David thought about Goliath's size at all, it was probably just to say, well, you know what they say, the bigger they are, the harder they fall. That guy's going to leave a pretty substantial dent in the ground by the time this day's over. He just was not moved in his circumstances because his viewpoint of God's faithfulness and trustworthiness was just completely steady in every situation that he was in. And David ends up changing Saul's heart here and Saul's mind on the issue. He's talked him into it. Because of this rock solid faith of David that we're getting to see like the primo example for. What does rock solid faith look like? Like super steady and stable faith. It looks just like this. It's when God's size doesn't change based on how big you perceive your problems around you to be. You know, the perfect contrary example of that would be Peter walking on the water, right? He got out there and walked on the water for a little while, which tells me that he at least had the faith to believe that God could make him buoyant, I guess. But then what happened? Problem changed. The situation changed. His viewpoint changed. And when he really saw just how strong the winds were and how big those waves were, what did it do? It caused his faith in the Lord to waver. It caused him to doubt. Okay, yes, I believed that God is big enough to make me buoyant on the water, but oh man, when it comes to waves like that, when it comes to winds like that, when it comes to a situation that's this bad, yeah, I don't know if the Lord can pull this off for me. But David, through this perfect example of his steady faith, has now changed the heart and the mind of Saul. Saul was against David serving as Israel's warrior to send out there and to go into battle against Goliath. And honestly, when you have an army of grown men that are experienced in battle, they've done this sort of thing before, and they at least look like soldiers, you would probably, if you're Saul, be a little embarrassed to send the young teenager out there that doesn't look like a soldier. He looks like what he is, a shepherd. He doesn't have experience. You know he's not going to last 10 seconds. It would probably be embarrassing to do that, and you would probably be expecting Goliath to have a little bit of fun with this one. Super easy battle, but David was able to appeal to something that Saul had brushed up against with in his past. And that is faith in the greatness of God on behalf of those who trust in him. This is something Saul brushed up against a time or two in his life. I think it stirred old memories for him. And I do believe, it's possible that Saul sent him out expecting him to die. I doubt it. I really do believe that the rock steady faith of David here has caused the heart of Saul to hope. I think David's faith was contagious. I think that's the only reason why you let David do this if you're King Saul. And let's face it, faith is always that way. Faith is contagious. We just had this spiritual lesson not too long ago. Faith is always contagious, but so is everything else. You remember that? Doubt is contagious too. Murmuring and complaining, that's contagious too. Laziness, that's contagious too. So faith, if faith is contagious, then that's the kind of people we need to be rubbing up against in life. People that have great, rock, steady faith. Those are the kind of people we need to be around. Get those people in our circle, because that's good for us. If that's what we want to catch, a rock, steady faith, then get around rock, steady faith people. Reading on in verse 38. Then Saul clothed David with his armor. Saul's armor. Saul trying to put his armor on David. He put a helmet of bronze on his head and clothed him with a coat of mail. 39. And David strapped his sword over his armor, and he tried in vain to go. So he's really giving this a shot. I mean, this is King Saul. What an honor for Saul to say, here, use my armor. What an honor that is. So he tried his best, but as we just read, he couldn't even go with it. In other words, he's trying to just walk in the armor, and he couldn't even walk in it. Why might that be? It's too big, obviously. Yeah, Saul is the tallest guy in all of Israel. We have no idea how tall David is, but we know he's not as tall as Saul. So obviously, with Saul shopping at the big and tall section and David just being your typical Israelite shepherd, the armor is not going to fit at all. But we understand what Saul is doing here, don't we? If you're Saul, I mean, could you send David out in his little, probably camel skin robe and no armor? I don't think you could do that in good conscience. You would want to do like Saul here. You'd want this guy to have some armor in the battle. Reading on, it says, for he had not tested them. So, yes, you do have to test armor out a little bit before you go into actual life and death battle with it. You need some practice with it. You need to train with it a little bit first. You need to know how that limits or changes your movements. You got to get accustomed to all that. This is not something you just do, buy some armor or throw on someone else's armor and then go out to battle and see if you survive. No, you don't do that. So then David said to Saul, I cannot go with these, for I have not tested them. So David put them off. And I would just make the spiritual point to us that this is true in spiritual life too. You cannot fight in someone else's armor. Armor back then had to be custom fit for the person. And spiritual armor, our defenses in our spiritual battles today, that's custom fit armor, which means that's stuff that you've used before. Those are defenses, spiritual defenses that you've practiced. Those are spiritual defenses that you have experience with and you know they prove out, they test out, they actually work. You can't go by what someone else says works, can you? You can't go based on someone else's spiritual armor, their tactics, or their strategies, but instead, you need time with the Lord, fighting battles with Him, proving out what works for you and Him. That takes time. It's like the seven sons of Sceva in Acts chapter 19, trying to cast out an unclean spirit. They thought it was a good time to try what the Apostle Paul did. So they said, we adjure you, unclean spirits, by the Jesus whom Paul preaches. Yeah, it worked for Paul. Probably will work for us. Well, that's about the worst time to experiment with spiritual strategies when you're trying to cast out an unclean spirit. No, obviously it didn't work. That's a terrible time to be trying on someone else's armor. That was good for Paul. That worked for Paul because Paul had tested that and knew that to work for him. That did not work for the seven sons of Sceva. Reading on in verse 40, then he took his staff in his hand. So this is now going to be a list of all the stuff that David's going to take into battle that he has proved. He's tested this stuff. He knows this stuff works. He knows how to use this stuff. He's good with this stuff. First of all, the staff, which is a shepherd's staff. And he chose 5 smooth stones from the brook and put them in his shepherd's pouch. His sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. Now, this is interesting what we just read. Verse 40. You can look up pictures of this valley online, the Valley of Elah. This brook that's being referred to, that's actually at about the midway point of the Valley of Elah. So what that means is that David is about halfway out there. We don't know where Goliath was at this point, but he's probably somewhere around the same area, right? He's out there in the valley calling them on. David is about halfway through this valley before he even picks up stones for his sling. So he left where Saul was, and he went out there, in my own terminology, without any ammo. And he's about face to face with the giant out there in the valley before he even finds ammo for his sling. I just think that's a pretty brave act on David's part. He goes out there. What if there weren't 5 stones out there? I don't know what was his backup plan. I'll just beat that guy over the head with my staff until he drops. And the Lord's going to put the power behind it. I don't care what I have to use. Kick him in the shins, knee him in the gut when he's down. I'll figure it out. He's just out there trusting the Lord. And he does pick up 5 smooth stones at the brook. Why did he pick up 5 stones and not just 1? That's weak faith, right? No, it's definitely not weak faith. Did he think he might need 5 to bring Goliath down? That's possible. That is possible. Maybe he thought, well, that is a pretty big guy. It probably wouldn't hurt to be able to get off some extra shots. I know this is not a semi-automatic sling, but I could probably get off a handful pretty quick. I better take some backup stones. I think more than likely, you agree with me on this, that the reason why he picked up 5 stones was because Goliath, we are told in the book of 2 Samuel chapter 5, verse 19, he actually had 4 brothers, and they were giants too, of course. So there's 5 giants out there. And whether David knew that they were his brothers or not, if you see 5 giants and you know you got to kill one, you probably figure the other 4 giants won't take too kindly to that when you do. So I think it's very possible that David actually went out there prepared to kill all 5 of those giants. Would that surprise you if that was where David's faith was in this moment? Wouldn't surprise me a bit. This is the guy that takes lions by the beards. All right? Verse 41, and the Philistine moved forward and came near to David with his shield bearer in front of him. So that would be Goliath's shield bearer, not David's. David's out there without a shield. He's out there without a shield bearer. He doesn't even have armor on. Verse 42, and when the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth, ruddy, which we discovered means reddish. So maybe he had reddish hair, or maybe he had a really nice suntan from shepherd work. Either way, he was reddish and handsome in appearance. In other words, David looks more like a choir boy than a warrior. And Goliath found that very insulting. He's expecting this to be like the main card on the fight event of the year. He wants a competition. He wants a battle. He wants to be able to get his adrenaline up. So he's expecting a warrior, and they send him out pretty boy instead. Really? You're sending out the choir boy. Come on. So he's insulted. Felt like a slap in the face. Verse 43, and the Philistine said to David, Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? What are we doing? Are we playing fetch or are we fighting a battle here? You brought a stick to a battle against a giant. You come to me with sticks. And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. Verse 44. The Philistine said to David, "Come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and to the beast of the field." So Goliath was a pretty good trash talker. And I guess when you're 9 foot 9 inches, you can stand to be. He probably never had anyone sit him down or disprove any of the threats and trash talking that he had made in the past. But David's a different animal. Verse 45. Then David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord." All caps. That means Yahweh. "I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts," or armies, "the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied." Oh, I love this so much. I love this so much. He says, "You have a sword, but I have the name. You have the spear, but I have the name. You have the javelin, but I have the name. I come to you in the name of the Lord. I know the name of the Lord, and I come to you in His authority." If you're heading into your battles with only the name above all names, you're going to be all right. Whatever else it is that you're lacking, if you come with faith in the name above all names, everything's going to come out just all right. Because with that name comes promise. With that name comes authority. With that name comes victory. "I come in the name of the one you have defied." In other words, you've challenged him, not me. You done messed up. Your fight is with him, not me. So you're toast, buddy. I think the VeggieTales version of this is quite apt in this location. It would be this: he's big, but God's bigger. Verse 46. "This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand." This is David talking to Goliath. "This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. And I will give the dead bodies of the host. I will give the dead bodies of the host of the Philistines this day to the birds of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel." So Goliath can't say he wasn't warned here. David tried. Verse 47. "And that all this assembly may know that the Lord saves, not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and He will give you into our hand." Isn't that beautiful? Isn't that beautiful faith? And aren't those beautiful words? I love this story. And I don't want you to think that David is like caught up in the trash talking and that he's just trash talking back here. Oh yeah? Well, take this, buddy. He isn't caught up in the trash talking. He's actually warning Goliath. He's telling Goliath exactly how this is going to play out. And sure enough, it is going to play out exactly as David has said it here. Coming into this battle the way that David does, this is something unique to the people of God. It is not something that the world could ever possibly understand or know. It is not mere worldly confidence as the world knows it. Yes, you can be pretty sure you're going to whoop someone in a battle. You can be pretty sure that something's going to go in your favor. You can have a great deal of confidence in that. But the confidence that David has in God here, it's completely different than that. It's a sure and fixed thing. It's not just like a real hope with a high possibility of success. But it is a sure knowledge, to the extent that we would have to say David is not entering this battle for the purpose of victory, but he's actually entering this battle from a place of victory. He already knows that the victory is his. He is assured of that in his heart. All he's got to do is just let the results play themselves out. That's how strong and stable his faith is in the Lord. Verse 48, when the Philistine arose and came and drew near to meet David, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. I'm going to make a guess here that this is probably the first time that anyone had ever charged Goliath in a battle. Don't you think? Goliath probably never experienced this before. I'm sure he experienced the exact opposite all the time. People running from him because with a guy that's 9 foot, nine inches of solid muscle, what's your main goal in fighting him? Don't let him get a hold of you. You know, in MMA, some folks are not good ground fighters. They're okay if they're standing up punching. They're not good ground fighters. If you get them on the ground, they lose the match. So they'll tell the guy, don't let him get you on the ground. Keep jabbing, keep moving, don't let him get you on the ground. That's how you would, I think, want to fight Goliath. Don't let him get his big paws around you. But here's David, little David, charging Goliath, verse 49. And David put his hand in his bag and took out the 50 caliber. No. And took out a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine on his forehead. The stone sank into his forehead, and he, Goliath, fell on his face to the ground. What's the moral of the story there? David was very good aim. I don't think that's it. I don't think that's the moral of the story. I think the moral of the story is that the smallest thing you commit to the Lord, he is able to take that and use that for giant purposes. I think that's the moral of the story. It's not so much about what David did. It's about what God did with what David had. God took control of that stone. I think you should know that. I have no doubt that David was a great aim, a crack shot. I have no doubt about that. That probably gave him some confidence in this, but that's not what happened here. That's not what this is about. This is not about David's aim. It's not about his skill level with the sling. That would detract from the actual point of the story. The actual point of the story is that God took control of what David released for his purposes. The same kind of moral of the story that the Lord wants you to know as a Christian, that the things that you release for him, the things that you put your hand to do for him, when you let them go and then trust God with them, God's going to do big things with that. I truly, honestly believe that David could have like totally botched it, and that thing could have flung out of his sling wrong, bounced off a tree, and if it would have, it would have ricocheted and still cracked Goliath right straight in the forehead. I believe he could have fumbled that so bad that it did a double hop off of the ground, but if so, the Lord would have taken that stone and it would have hopped up and cracked Goliath right in the skull. I believe no matter how David flung that, no matter how bad he could have botched that, that the Lord was going to take that stone and make sure that it hit its target, the one that the Lord wanted it to hit. And at this point, all anyone knows is that Goliath is down. That's about all you could see from the distances of both armies. Israel on one hillside, the Philistines on another. So you probably have the Philistines chuckling like, oh, that Goliath, he is such a kidder. Look how he's toying with that little kid, giving him some hope. That's all right. Wait for it. Any minute. He's going to hop up on his feet and cut that kid in half. And then the Israelites are probably over there like, David, don't believe it. Don't trust him. He's going to get up. He's fooling with you. Run. But we read in verse 50. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and with a stone. That means at the very least, he knocked him out with the sling and the stone. And that was pretty much the end of the battle there. And then it says, and struck the Philistine and killed him. I personally lean toward that this being the actual act of killing him with the sword. I think it seems more reasonable that the stone knocked him out and that David then finished him off and killed him with the sword. Now, it could be the other way because it was the Lord controlling the stone. It could have hit him in the forehead and that stone could have been the thing that killed him. That's possible. But the way that I read verse 50 is two separate things. David prevailed over him with a sling and a stone and struck the Philistine and killed him with the sword. And then the scripture tells us there was no sword in the hand of David. So he did kill him with the sword. But David didn't bring a sword to this battle. If you'll remember from our study of Judges, the Philistines were great at metallurgy. They had incredible weaponry, but the Israelites did not, because for the longest time, the Philistines were kind of controlling that. They had the nation of Israel under subjection, and they would not allow them to make weapons. Do you remember that? They were actually charging them a lot of money just to have their tools, their farming tools, brought to blacksmiths for sharpening. They charged them a ton of money there just to make sure that they weren't developing weapons. We were told a couple chapters ago that of the entire army of Israel, only Saul and Jonathan had swords. So David didn't even have a sword. But what do you know? Goliath does. Isn't that handy? Verse 51. Then David ran and stood over the Philistine and took his sword. Goliath's sword. David took Goliath's sword, which again, probably weighed like 15 pounds. David was lucky to swing it. He was probably sore the next day, if he's anything like me. Took his sword and drew it out of its sheath and killed him. There you go. See? And killed him. And cut off his head with it. When the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. Okay, so now he's dead for sure. Maybe you do recover from a stone in the forehead. Maybe you don't. But you don't recover from having your head lopped off. Although you could probably go to the Uniontown Hospital in that condition and they'd say, you know, we've run our tests. We can't find anything wrong with you. The head's right. It's separate. It didn't come up in the test. I'm sorry. I don't know why I do that. I don't know why I'm the way I am. They did save my life after trying to kill me the first time. So I'm just grateful that Lord forgive me. All right, why cut off the head? Why do that? Well, first of all, he promised him he would, and you can't break your promises, right? He promised him, I'm going to cut your head off, and he fulfilled that promise. But secondly, this was the way for men on both sides to know that this battle had been decided. Goliath on the ground, that does not mean it's over. Holding up Goliath's head for both sides to see, that definitely means it's over. That means he's not just down for the count. He's out for good. David, little David, the shepherd boy, has killed the giant. And now the Philistines fled the scene. Why did they flee the scene? Are they afraid of David, do you think? I hardly think they're afraid of David. I mean, yeah, David may be good with the sling. He may have got lucky and killed Goliath, but a blind squirrel finds a nut every now and then. Yeah, but let's get 20 guys surrounding David, and he's not going to be so tough nor so lucky. I don't think the Philistines are afraid of David. I think the reason they fled the scene here is because David was not hesitant to declare to all of them that they had defied his God, that they had invoked his anger, and that God was going to fight this battle and overcome the Philistines. And I think that after David did what he did, the Philistines actually believed David. Oh man, he's right. Here we go again. We've heard the stories from the past about Israel and Israel's God. Here we go again. Israel's God is fighting for the nation again. Let's get out of here. I fully believe that's why they ran. Not afraid of David, but afraid of David's God. And isn't that the way, you know, people see your blessed life? They're going to see your victories. They're going to see that you are passing your life tests with flying colors. And that even in your struggles, you maintain joy. You maintain confidence and trust in the Lord. They're going to see all of that stuff. And then the question becomes, okay, did you give them enough information prior to that so that they know why that's happening in your life? More than just, well, I go to church. Are you letting them know? Are you vocal like David was? That God is fighting for me. I come with the name. I know the name. I have the name. I come in His authority. I come with His promises. He's good to me. I trust in Him. Are you vocal like that with David? Because if you are vocal about where you're going with your life, then when people see how your life goes, they're going to know the source of it. And that's going to give a real possibility of that person's heart being opened to faith in the Lord. Verse 52. Let's hurry this up. And the men of Israel and Judah rose with a shout and pursued the Philistines as far as Gath and the gates of Ekron. So those are two of the five major cities of the Philistines. So that the wounded Philistines fell on the way from Sha'araim, as far as Gath and Ekron, 53. And the people of Israel came back from chasing the Philistines, and they plundered their camp. I think they got weapons now, verse 54. And David took the head of the Philistine. He took Goliath's head and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put his armor, Goliath's armor, in his tent. And he probably put it next to his bear rugs and his lion fur coats, I would guess. Right there in the game room. At least he didn't take the head and put, you know, mount that and stick that in the game room. He gave that to Israel. Don't ask me how long they kept that. Like, was that on display in the palace? I wouldn't think you'd want to keep that more than a few days. That becomes a very terrible souvenir after just a few days. But David keeps a souvenir for himself, the armor of Goliath, and he gives the souvenir of the head of Goliath to the nation. That may be a little bit excessive on David's part, maybe. I'm not sure he really needed to do that. But at least with David, you know that if he has done this, it is in the spirit of worshiping God and crediting God for God winning this battle. It's not for him to take credit. Saul would do this very differently, wouldn't he? He'd build another memorial to himself. And he'd stick the head of Goliath up there on the sword. But David's different. David gives the Lord credit. Verse 55. As soon as Saul saw David go out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, and we'll be talking about Abner in the future. You'll get to know him pretty well. He said to Abner, the commander of the army, Abner, whose son is this youth? And Abner said, as your soul lives, O king, I do not know. Verse 56. And the king said, inquire whose son the boy is. Verse 57. And as soon as David returned from the striking down of the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistines in his hand. Verse 58. And Saul said to him, Saul speaking to David, he said, whose son are you, young man? And David answered, I am the son of your servant, Jesse, the Bethlehemite. Now, I know what you're thinking right about now. You're thinking, what in the world is Saul gone senile here or what? David works for Saul. David knows Saul. Why is Saul acting like he doesn't know who David is? He sent messages to David's father. How is he acting like he doesn't know who David's father is? And the answer is actually really simple. The explanation to that is that there's no statement in here that's telling us that Saul is confused about who David is. He knows who David is. His question is not even about where David's dad lives, because he sent messages there. His question here is about the proper name of David's father. He wants to know the actual name of David's father. He's just sent messages. Remember, both times he said, send messages to David's father and ask David's father this. Now he wants to know the name of David's father. Why might he want to know the name of David's father, the proper name? Here's the answer. There's paperwork to do. There's legal paperwork to do. Because remember what Saul was giving for the person that killed Goliath? Not just tried, you had to kill the guy, but for the person that killed Goliath, there was that incentive package. The first incentive was, you get to marry my daughter. So that's legal paperwork. That's a wedding invitation for Jesse's father. Then you got incentive number two, which was great wealth. So this guy's going to he's got to have a bank account. He's going to have money turned over to him. Yes, they did things legally like that with paperwork. And then finally, Saul has to send a letter to the IRS, the Israeli Revenue Service, and say this guy and his whole family, they are now tax free, tax exempt in the land of Israel. No property taxes. Their house is free and clear. No sales tax. No income tax. This guy's free and clear. There's paperwork to be done. These are legal matters. Saul is not at all regretting the incentive package. He's ready to go. He's ready to sign it over because David, he took on the giant and he killed the giant. And I hope Saul knows that it was actually God working through David.